This is John Rabat with Walter Adams at his office on July 10th, 1992. My notes for the interview questions to you say December 19th, 1991, but I don't think we ever got that date.
We never made it.
We never made that date. What I mainly wanted to talk to you about, Walter, today was a couple pieces of your early relations with the MSU Labor Industrial Relations Center, because I was working on a project related to that, and a couple questions related to MSU campus union and administrative relations, and a few things about the faculty unionization efforts and the faculty grievance procedures that you've related to over the years. But if you wouldn't mind, if I could just start out by asking you your name, when you were born, and just briefly why and how you got into economics and the particular aspect of economics of corporation structures and studies that you did.
Well, I was born August 27, 1922. I came to Michigan State in September of 1947 and have been here ever since. Am I speaking loudly
just
enough?
Just fine.
My special field of interest in the economics is industrial organization, antitrust economics, government and business relations. The area is usually referred to by different titles. But my major concern has always been the nature of power, indeed the political economy of power, because I felt that you can't segregate economics from the political world. Economic power spills over into political power. Economic power is either used in the marketplace, if convenient, and if necessary or convenient or desirable, economic power tries to manipulate the state for a private advantage, whether it's protection from competition, either domestic or foreign. Whether it is to obtain subsidies and favors or handouts from the state, whether it is bailouts to save the corporation from the consequences of its own malfeasance, nonfeasance, misfeasance, whatever. So I don't think you can study the economics in isolation from the political and social world in which it exists. My interest in the field, I guess, was generated by the two major formative influences in my life, namely the Great Depression of the 1930s and World War II. The rise of totalitarianism in Europe and its eventual consequences. The corporate state, the communist state, the fascist state, the imperial Japanese state, okay? These were experiences of my youth, and to me, World War II was the culmination of the ultimate implication, the ultimate consequences of the use and abuse of that great concentrated power. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if I've been fully responsive to your question.
That got me. During... You came here as a faculty member in 47?
I came here as an assistant professor of economics after finishing my graduate work at Yale. I had started graduate work at the University of Chicago that was interrupted by World War II, and when I came back, My parents lived in New York City, and they didn't want me to go as far away again as Chicago because they had missed me for 3 years. So the compromise was that I'd go to an East Coast institution, and I drove up to New Haven, Connecticut, walked into the dean's office, asked him, "Will you have me with these credentials?" They hadn't seen a man in 4 years, so I was embraced immediately, and that's the explanation of my getting my PhD at Yale. Uh-huh.
And then how did you happen to hook up with Michigan State University? And
well,
what was this place like in 47 for a new faculty member?
Well, I can tell you it was a culture shock. To arrive in East Lansing. My fellow graduate students at Yale, when I told them I had an offer from Michigan State, or Michigan State College as it was then called, half of them said, "You like Ann Arbor, it's a nice town." And the other half, who knew the difference between Michigan and Michigan State, said, "You're very lucky, you're going to an agricultural institution and students will bring you butter and eggs and venison and so on."
Did they?
So much for the sophisticated Easterner and their knowledge of geography or the facts of life in Indian country as they viewed it. What kind of institution was it at the time? It was it had roughly 10,000 students. It was a good agricultural college. That is, it had all the agricultural disciplines and those sciences which were the base of the agricultural disciplines. It was strong in botany and zoology, etc. The Sunday New York Times arrived at the Union Desk Tuesday noon. If you asked for a bagel in one of the bakeries, they had never heard of it. My wife asked the milkman, in those days milk was still delivered, whether he carried sour cream. He assured her that all his cream was fresh. On the faculty, most of the people had gotten their degrees either at Michigan or Wisconsin, and some at Minnesota, but it was not geographically diversified. Faculty in terms of origin.
You were coming into the business school's economics department, or
well,
was the structure
there? At that time, the economics department was part of the College of Science and Arts. The economics department and agricultural economics were a single department. And I must say that the colleagues in the department who had the ag econ specialty were probably the more preeminent segment of the economics faculty at the time, and again, understandably so, given the origins and traditions of the institution. Why don't you lower that window just a little bit, cut down on the noise. Yeah, that's better, that's good enough.
That was obviously then the boom growth period. And that's
exactly,
been
1947 was really a seller's market as far as new faculty members were concerned, and one of the great attractions of Michigan State was that they offered housing for faculty, and the salary was competitive, and for my wife and me, this represented an adventure, and coming out here to a section of the country that I knew very little about. It
wasn't
was
provided for free, or that you
no,
could
no,
live
no,
in
no.
Cherry.
Oh. We lived in the brick apartments in Cherry Lane, and they were brand new, and they were perfectly comfortable, answered our needs. We had one child, and we were eligible for a one-bedroom apartment. I forget what the rental was, but it was a modest rental. There really was no rental housing in East Lansing at that time. The only housing complex was the Hillcrest apartments, and they were all taken. So the university had a tremendous investment in housing. They had the brick apartments in Cherry Lane. They had old army barracks that John Hanna had obtained from the government. They had so-called British Empire houses. These were all prefabs. They even had trailers and Quonset huts, some for faculty, some for students. So there was an explosion of student enrollment and a new faculty coming in, and this diversified the faculty both geographically and in terms of their academic interests. So it really was the starting point of the building process, which created the kind of university that Michigan State is today.
Exciting place to be in some ways, though?
It was very exciting place to be.
What were the relationships between the faculty and administrators? And
it was a very clearly defined hierarchical relationship. The department chair was called department head, and that was a fitting description of his function and his role. The department head in economics in 1947 was the only full professor in the department. He was one full professor. There was one other full professor, and he was the head of the ag econ section within the department.
Who was it at that time?
It was
heard of ever?
Yes. His name was Clifford Hardin, H-A-R-D-I-N, later to become Secretary of Agriculture in the Nixon administration. He was part of what we derisively called the Purdue Mafia, because a lot of our ag econ people had Purdue roots. There, as I say, the department head ruled the department with a firm, absolute hand. At his discretion, he consulted at times what he called the senior men individually and privately. But there was no question about the fact that his decisions were final decisions in the form of recommendations made to his superiors, namely the dean of the College of Science and Arts. And the dean in turn had absolute say over what went on in his college.
Which dean were you under?
It was Dean Emmons, who was a tough, hands-on administrator. And I assumed when I was projected into this environment that everybody in a position of power at Michigan State was a member in good standing of the Republican Party. It was years later that I found out that Dean Emmons, in the 1920s, had voted Democratic. I couldn't believe that that kind of anomaly was possible in the East Lansing of that time.
Uh-huh. Now the field that, or the parts of economics that some of the young people, I assume many or most of them were young that were coming in,
yes,
were somewhat different than the traditional agricultural related economics that had dominated the department. And
That's correct. I mean, I taught the course which had the title Free Enterprise in Public Policy, which was a course required of all business administration majors.
Uh-huh.
Another requirement, I also taught the principles of economics, the elementary course, which was required of all business administration majors. Then there was another course required of all biz ad majors, that was labor economics. And that was an institutional, historically oriented course, essentially about the role of labor unions in the American economy.
Who taught that?
Well, when I came, Killingsworth had just been hired as an associate professor in the department to head up the labor group. And a third required course was money and banking, which again was taught by some new people. One of them in particular I recall is Lawrence Ritter, R-I-T-T-E-R, who later went to NYU, but who is most notable for the fact that he's written three best-selling books on baseball. His latest his latest book was on old ballparks, it just came out.
Okay.
A fascinating book on Ebbets Field and Shive Park, Philadelphia, and the Polo Grounds. A fascinating book.
So the three required were principles, labor econ, and money and banking?
And the free enterprise and public policy.
Okay. And that was the one you taught.
Yeah. And that really gave the business administration student a good background as to the functioning of the American economy.
Uh-huh.
For example, in addition to the money and banking text that was used, the instructors decided to use the autobiography of Mariner Eccles, who was the New Deal head of the Federal
mm-hmm.
Reserve System. So it was that kind
uh-huh.
of course, and really, I hesitate to use the cliche, stretched the minds.
Uh-huh.
Of the kind of student who came to Michigan State.
But you felt
in those years
that made it enjoyable to teach.
Oh, it was very exciting.
Uh-huh.
Very exciting.
What kind of work were you doing at that time in terms of research and writing?
Well, the same kind of work that I've done for
okay.
for the last 45 years. I wrote articles. My first book was a book of readings in economics, which was a supplement to the principles course, and in 1950 I published the Structure of American Industry, which is now in its eighth edition, which is a collection of industry studies.
Mm-hmm.
The real world rather than
mm-hmm.
abstract theorizing and
mm-hmm.
model building, which is so popular these days in the economics.
I read one of the editions. I have to look at it to see which edition mine is. Maybe more in the middle.
Yeah, probably.
where
did you come across it? Where did you study it?
I think I came across it in working on a master's in labor studies.
Where?
UMass Amherst.
Oh, yes.
I think it was on it wasn't the required text, but a supplemental and or recommended or read parts of it.
Yeah,
for
that
something with History of American Economy with Edwards, I think.
I don't think.
early 70s.
Yeah.
Anyways, I don't want to miss a story, but I don't want to jump too far ahead, but this kind of hierarchical relationship and the discretion of the department head to consult with the senior men and that sort of thing, I do want to find out at some point how that starts breaking up to the extent that it does, and those aspects where you think it doesn't.
Well, for example, let me give you a concrete example. Salaries were highly classified information. That is, the CIA does not guard its secrets as closely as salary information was guarded at Michigan State. People, of course, informally would discuss the salary situation. The big change in our department came when Chuck LaRue arrived on the campus in the middle 50s. The department at that time would send information around to the members of the faculty with a routing slip which had all of our names on it. Well, LaRue had a rubber stamp made which said, my salary last year was, and then there was a blank which he filled in, my salary this year is, and the blank. And of course each year he filled in a different salary, and he put a hit that rubber stamp on the routing slips, see. So that was a one-man protest, you uh-huh. might say. The interesting thing, when we fought for publicizing salaries, I had always anticipated that the people with the lowest salaries would be most in favor of publicizing salaries, to indicate the discrepancy between the top and the bottom. I was wrong. It was the people with the lowest salaries who were self-conscious, ashamed, reluctant to have their salaries published. So,
is that economic dysfunctional behavior?
I would think so, but again, it shows you the danger of theorizing about human behavior without actually looking at it and seeing how it functions.
The actual publicizing story, I think, came up when I interviewed Ripas, and that becomes a much later story, correct?
Yes, I think so, because Ripas didn't come in until the late 50s,
right.
as I, early
right.
60s, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I don't trust my recollection, but that's
right.
my impression.
And I remember that discussion coming up with that interview. But I was just curious about when and how that changed. What about the faculty senate and the governance sort of thing? What was that? That was non-existent in the late 40s, early 50s, and came only much later?
Again, to the best of my recollection, that came much later, because just as the head of the department would consult the senior men privately and informally, the president would do the same thing. That is, there was the same kind of hierarchy up and down the line. Indeed, jumping ahead a little bit, I remember an AUP meeting on campus in the middle 1960s, to which we had invited John Hanna to speak. And during the question period, I raised some nettlesome questions. And afterwards, I went up to shake the old man's hand to indicate that there was nothing personal in my questions. And he said to me, Walter, you've been around here long enough to know better than to ask those fool questions. What do you want anyhow? I said, Mr. President, you're not going to believe this, but I'm sick and tired of the phony democracy we have around here now. I want to go back to the good old days when John Hanna was the absolute dictator at Michigan State University. And you know, to some extent that was true, because in those days, you could look John Hanna, who was the ultimate authority of on everything, you could look him in the eye, state your case, and if he believed that you had the best interests of the university in mind, however misguided he thought you might be, there was no punishment for that. There was no retaliation. But if he thought you had a private axe to grind, he was merciless. Well, that was a good enough standard for me. Let me share with you an incident that may illustrate the kind of institution it was. I had done, in the late 40s, I had done some of my earliest writings was on the basing point system, an esoteric system of pricing used by the steel industry and the cement industry, and the gypsum industry. Well, in 1949, I was invited to testify before a congressional committee. The Supreme Court had just said that the basing point system was conspiratorial and a violation of the antitrust laws. And the steel and cement people were anxious to have the Congress legalize the system. Well, I testified against the legalization of the basing point system. It must have been a slow day on Capitol Hill, because my testimony made the front page of the NAM weekly newsletter. That newsletter arrived on the desk of a fellow by the name of Carlton, C-A-R-L-T-O-N, who was executive vice president of the Motor Wheel Corporation, headquartered in Lansing. And at that time, in the Lansing of that day, Motor Wheel was a powerful, powerful economic factor in the community. Carlton read this article and dashed off a letter addressed to Herman Weingarten, who was the department head who had hired me in economics, but by 1949 he had become dean. And the last paragraph in that letter said, "I wish this statement had come from someone other than an assistant professor at Michigan State College." The dean stupidly took that letter and, in his own handwriting, across the bottom of it, "See what you have done," and sent it to me. Well, what does an untenured assistant professor do under those circumstances? I picked up the phone and I called Carlton and asked for an appointment, which he graciously gave me. And I said, "Mr. Carlton, I was really disappointed with the letter that you wrote to my dean. If you had something to say, you should have said it to me first. Furthermore, I am young and inexperienced in the ways of the world. I may be perfectly wrong about the basing point system. You know the world of industry. Why didn't you call me up and ask me for a cup of coffee and tell me specifically where my testimony was wrong, mistaken, misguided? You could have taught me and through me a large number of students. You didn't do that. I don't think that was cricket." To his credit, he apologized, and 2 weeks later invited my wife and me to dinner at his house. But the dean tried to punish me.
Did you report that meeting to the dean?
The dean was at dinner with me at Carlton's house, together with the president of Motor Wheel. So it was, Carlton thought it was 2 and 2, actually it was 3 and 1. The dean always cut the salary recommendation that he received from the department. Charles Killingsworth by then was head of the department. Finally, it got so bad that Charles protested to the president. And John Hanna called me in. And he said, Adams, I want to have a look at you to see if you have horns. And I said, Mr. President, I'm an ambitious young man. I want to rise in the system. Tell me, is my teaching deficient? Is my research deficient? Am I a source of embarrassment to the university because I testify before committees of Congress? He said, no, no, you're doing fine. He said, just settle down and become a member of the community, buy a house in East Lansing. I said, well, I can't buy a house as an untenured assistant professor. He said, you'll be all right. 4 weeks later, I get a pink slip with the notation, the as it was then called, the trustees were called the State Board of Agriculture at its last meeting, has voted to increase your salary by $500, which was a fortune in those days. Well, I tell you that to indicate that it was personal bargaining, the mm-hmm. personal relationship, your personal standing
mm-hmm.
in the hierarchy that determined what your salary would be, whether you'd get promoted or not promoted, etc., etc. There was no systematic way. There was no personnel policy
mm-hmm.
or anything approximating it. It was all personal discretion
mm-hmm.
By the people up and down the hierarchical
mm-hmm.
ladder that determined the fate of individuals on the
yeah.
faculty, on the staff, etc., etc.
And we could get into a variety of ways from there. There are many ways in which it's code. There are lots of codes and regulations and rules, but there's certain aspect of that that I might argue is not all that drastically different.
Well, of course, that's what I call a phony democracy.
Okay.
Here, this was up front. Everybody
uh-huh.
understood the rules, you see. You knew the kind of system in which you function.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an informal mechanism for redress of grievances.
Uh-huh.
That is, you could protest to your department head, you could protest to your dean, you could protest to John Hanna. John Hanna was accessible. He had an open door. If you wanted an appointment with John Hanna, no matter how lowly a member of the faculty you were, within a week, you had an appointment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Your sense that that was terribly atypical among land-grant institutions or colleges in general in this area or elsewhere from what you knew from other colleagues' experience via national meetings or
yes.
regional meetings?
Well, I would assume that, I don't know how it was at other land-grant colleges.
Uh-huh.
It may have been typical of land-grant colleges, but it certainly wasn't typical of a university like Michigan, for example. And I think Wisconsin probably had a democratic tradition.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was, after all, it was the land of La Follette, you know, and there was such a thing as a Wisconsin tradition.
Well, I was curious if it related to land grants or if it related to...
I don't know.
The growth period or...
Certainly at the more...
Prestigious
institutions, the Harvards and the Yales and so on, there was much much more faculty participation and decision making than there was certainly in the Michigan State of the 40s and 50s and certainly before then.
We can go terribly chronologically, or we can go sort of thematically.
However you want to go.
Well, if you don't mind going thematically, I guess I'd like to just stick on this piece just
okay.
for a second.
Sure.
What were the factors then, and what, just big stories, were key events, people, or whatever, started changing that, whether, and you can comment or editorialize on to what extent it's true or phony or whatever, but we end up by the late 70s with a lot of faculty, if not belief, at least involvement in various kind of governance structures and systems. Obviously, the institution you're describing in the mid-50s is not very much like the one by the mid-70s. I assume it's in between there that some of that changes. I don't know if you want to comment anything about that.
Well, the change obviously was gradual. In part because the marketplace for academic talent was still pretty much a seller's market, especially after 1957 when the Russians launched the Sputnik. Everybody believed in investing in education.
Mm-hmm.
In order to beat the Russians into space, into the moon, whatever, okay. So the general atmosphere was very supportive of higher education, which meant the jobs were easier to get, which meant that you were less of an indentured servant at the institution where you happened to find yourself. And therefore, some of the authoritarian atmosphere was gradually eroded and broken down. You just couldn't get away with it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The types of people who came in, a Chuck LaRue, at first an extremely lonely voice, you see, would stand his ground on the question of publicizing salaries. We had a debate in the early 60s, I think it was, on whether ROTC should be compulsory or not. Well, nobody would have raised a question like that in the late 40s. Well, but faculty members came forward, the assistant professors came forward and took a stand on that issue.
ROTC was required for everyone or all males? Or?
Required for all, the first 2 years of ROTC, the so-called basic ROTC, was required of all male students except those physically unfit until the middle 60s, as I recall it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had a faculty committee to look into the matter, and the committee recommended that ROTC should become 2 years of ROTC should become optional. It was a big fight, debate in the Senate. One of the trustees accused the chairman of the committee bringing in that recommendation of communism. Incidentally, the chairman of that committee was a political science professor by the name of Jola Palombara, L-A, capital P, A-L, O-M-B-A-R-A, who 2 or 3 years later became a professor of political science at Yale, where he is today.
This is the first time you've mentioned faculty senate. Was it in existence, but a non-entity in the 40s?
No, it was in existence. There was a faculty senate, but only people with tenure were eligible for membership in the senate. It was a, quote, deliberative body, which didn't have power to approve the curriculum, and curriculum changes had to go through the Senate. But the Senate really was a fiefdom of John Hanna. He certainly never had any problem getting anything he wanted. through the Senate.
Did it meet fairly regularly?
It met regularly. I believe it met once a quarter.
Mm.
And then there was a faculty assembly to which everybody belonged, irrespective of rank. But that was primarily an organization to get university-wide instructions, announcements, and so on. It had very, as I recall it, really no significant powers or role to play in the governance system of the university.
I came in 77, and I don't even remember a faculty assembly.
No, that it was gone by then, because the Senate today is composed of all faculty members.
Mm-hmm. And that must have happened in the late 60s or early
70s. I would assume so, yes.
Mm-hmm. Going back then, you mentioned about Killingsworth at some point being chair. One of my questionnaires was concerning MSU's venture into labor industrial relations, creating the LIR Center, and with that getting into adult labor education, worker education. I was curious if you had any relationship to that effort, or...
Well, it was very interesting. John Hanna was a civilized conservative, okay?
Uh-huh.
That's the way I would describe him. And he had an astute political sense. That is, the growth that took place at Michigan State was financed almost exclusively by public money. That is, by legislative appropriations. And our primary political action committee, if I can use the term, not in
mm-hmm.
its literal sense,
right.
but in its functional sense, was the agricultural community.
Mm-hmm.
The extension agents in the field, the work we had done for the farming community, and so on and so forth. That was the backbone of our political support
mm-hmm.
in the legislature. But in the 40s, labor became a more potent political force in the state. And John Hanna decided that if we were going to provide a variety of services to the agricultural community, why not do the same thing for the labor community? Now, whether he was motivated politically by that or academically, I really don't know. It's probably some of both,
mm-hmm.
okay? And that was the origin of the Labor and Industrial Relations Center. And then I can't give you the exact year when this...
That's okay. I know that.
Okay, you know
late
this...
Late 50s.
Okay, the story which converted the center into a school.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But the center was conceived originally as a research arm and as an extension arm, okay? And our people went out and taught courses for labor unions. The one course that always brought a smile to my face was the one on parliamentary procedure,
uh-huh.
because when I attended Democratic state conventions, you could tell the labor folks who had gone through the course in parliamentary procedure,
uh-huh.
raising points of order and
uh-huh.
personal privilege and so on. So
you personally had know what was happening.
Exactly.
That kind of
they
stuff.
Had they
well,
had learned their lessons.
As I understand it, many of the early faculty in the Labor Center had joint appointments with the economic
exactly.
department.
Because Killingsworth was both head of the economics department and The labor and industrial relations.
Any particular stories to that, or?
Well, John Hanna had great respect for Killingsworth, and again, it went back to, I guess it was 1948, when Killingsworth was invited to give a talk to the Michigan Bankers Association on the Taft-Hartley Act. And I don't think you can imagine just how deeply wedded the Michigan corporate and banking community was to the Taft-Hartley Act. This was the greatest thing that had happened in a long time. Could you? Charles gave this talk to the Michigan Bankers Association, and in his usual clinical way, he demolished the Taft-Hartley Act. And the Michigan bankers were so impressed with that performance that they wrote to Hanna and told him about this miraculous man on his staff who attacked the Taft-Hartley Act and earned the applause of the Michigan bankers.
That
to Hanna was a great performance, and Charles's career at Michigan State was made by that single incident, if you can believe that.
I can believe that.
So, but again, it reflects on the basis for decisions, you see.
Uh-huh.
So when Hanna decided that we ought to make some sort of gesture to the labor community, it was obvious that Charles Killingsworth would be chosen to head up the Labor and Industrial Relations Center.